Hi, I'm Marion McPartland. My guest today on Piano Jazz is Lalo Schifrin. He's truly a Renaissance man of music, from his brilliant piano playing to his many compositions and arrangements for TV, films, concerts with symphony orchestra, and now the wonderful Jazz Meets the Symphony recordings, which are creating such a stir, such a wave of attention. Lalo, I'm so glad you could come and be on Piano Jazz. I really wasn't aware that you had done all those movies and TV things. I mean, that's a lifetime of work. You must have been doing that for years.
Yes, I did quite a lot. When I left New York, that was about 30-something years ago, I moved to California, and I went to only do two movies, and I finally stayed there.
Well, of course, the thing that is, I guess, follows you everywhere is Mission Impossible.
Yes.
And that's such a...
It keeps coming back.
I'll bet it does. But you know, I'll have to back up a little bit, because I guess not everybody knows that you're from Argentina, and I'm sure you had a musical background in your family when you... I mean, it's interesting how you got into jazz. There wasn't that much years ago, was there?
No, my father was a concertmaster. His name was Luis Schifrin. He was a concertmaster of the Buenos Aires Philharmonic. And his brother, Roberto Schifrin, was the first cello. So it was a family of musicians. And from my mother's side also, they're all classical musicians. And when I discovered in high school the first jazz record that drew my attention, Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, Big Spiderbeck, that was a kind of conversion, and I became obsessed with this kind of music. And my father said, "This is no music. If you cannot write it or read it, it's no music." But I knew that it was music, and I kept at it. And there was a new conversion when I heard for the first time Charlie Parker. I remember the record that it was Billy's Bounce.
Oh, yeah.
That completely... I was already into jazz, and I... Duke Ellington became one of my idols. I remember that Black, Brown, and Beige.
Yes.
See, that's the beginning of the influence on jazz music, the symphony, in a way. Long, extended compositions. And I listened to that. I don't know. I think I destroyed the record. Those days there were 78s. You know, and
yeah.
I destroyed the record. And it was not easy to get records in Argentina or jazz.
You know, before we go any further, I'd love to hear you play something.
Okay.
Could we come back up to present day? One of the many movie things that you wrote, you were telling me.
Yes, there's a movie that I did with Paul Newman called Cool Hand Luke, and the theme, which was called Down Here on the Ground, it became a kind of cult jazz theme, because Wes Montgomery did an album called Down Here on the Ground.
That's where
he
a great
plays
title.
That. And many of the great Oscar Peterson and George Benson and several people have done it, some of the greatest.
Love
so
to hear
I'm,
you do it.
I'm going to do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
course, I do know that tune now. I hear you play it. I don't think I saw the movie, but I have certainly heard the tune. It's almost like a jazz standard.
The movie had a... It was done in the 60s, and there was a line in the movie that Paul Newman says that became a kind of very popular in America. What we got here is a failure to communicate. I don't know if you remember that, but it became part of the folklore.
Yeah.
Yes.
You've done movies, it seems, with everybody. I mean, you did Clint Eastwood.
Oh, yes.
Dirty Harry.
Yes, oh, I did many movies with Clint Eastwood, about 10.
Goodness. And I was looking through the list, and I saw one that you, I may have heard that, with Jacques Cousteau.
Oh, yes, that was for television, one of the first Jacques Cousteau shows. I mean, actually, the first one, it was a two-hour movie.
Because I love that guy.
Yes, yes, oh, yes, he was very, very brilliant.
And the guy that was, I guess, the producer was David Wolper.
Yes, I did a lot of shows for him.
He's done some great things I'm really interested in.
The Making of the President in 1964.
Yeah.
The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Just things.
Yeah.
but it was fun. It was fun. I remember, you know, I have a funny thing to tell you about that. The first time that I worked for Wolper, there was a producer there who was doing a show called The Way Out Man. It was about the late, at that time, in the early 60s, the latest achievements of science. And they needed a very intellectual kind of atonal avant-garde music. And so the head of the music department of Wolper Production was Elmer Bernstein, the composer.
Oh, yes, famous name.
The one who wrote The Magnificent Seven and so many. And he couldn't do this show, because he was busy doing a movie, and they asked him to recommend somebody, and he recommended me. And the producer said, no, but he's a jazz musician. He cannot do this. Oh, no, he has a training in classical music, too. No, no, but he played with Dizzy Gillespie. I hear the jazz radio station. He plays good jazz, but he cannot do it. So finally, Elmer convinced him that I could do it. And when we met, he was very reluctant, you know. I mean, finally, when he heard what I did the day of the scoring, obviously he... And after that, I started a relationship with Wolper Productions. I did many, many shows for them.
Yeah, yeah, boy. Anyway, I want to hear you play more. What can you play? Another solo?
Well, maybe one of the things I've been doing in Jazz Meets the Symphony. Of course, I don't have the symphony, but at least I can do the theme, dedicated to Chano Pozzo, who was the great conga drummer who collaborated with Dizzy Gillespie and actually the marriage of Afro-Cuban music that happened in the late 40s and early 50s. Charlie Parker recording with Machito and Chano Pozzo. Actually, he co-composed Manteca and Con Alma and Wouldn't You, which was called Algo Bueno.
Wonderful tunes.
I asked Dizzy, how was your collaboration? Because Dizzy said that Chano Pozzo couldn't speak one word of English, and Dizzy didn't speak one word of Spanish, but they communicated through music.
That wouldn't bother Dizzy, though, would it?
No, I said, how do you write Manteca? Well, he wrote the tune, I wrote the bridge. So I'm going to play now a piece called Chano.
Okay. Thank you. God, that would be wonderful with the orchestra. I heard it actually with the Jazz Meets the Symphony. It's just a great, great piece.
Yes, and I think Paquito plays a beautiful solo in it. He's very inspired.
He's amazing, amazing musician. Well, boy, I mean, you've had the pick of the.
And also, John Faddis has a solo that is he plays the jazz part, and Paquito plays the Latin parts, and I think that the two of them they had it very well covered.
Boy, it must be a thrill just hearing all these things played back. But now, tell me, how did you meet Dizzy? Was it when he came to Argentina? Was that the first time you met Dizzy?
Yes, he came when he did a tour, the State Department tour with all the big all-star band. Phil Woods was in the band. Quincy Jones was playing four trumpet. I mean, Frank Rehak, he had a... Benny Golson was in the band, Melba Liston.
My goodness.
He went all over the world. He went to Pakistan. He went to... As a matter of fact, he did an album called Dizzy in Greece, which is the repertoire he played in that tour. And we were lucky in Buenos Aires because I had arrived from France, back from my studies at the conservatory, and I put together a big band myself. I wrote the charts, and the style of the band was between Dizzy's, believe it or not, because he was one of my idols, and Basie.
Well, you've got the best of both worlds.
Yeah. in a way, it was a miracle that he came at the end of that year. I was playing concerts, and I was invited also to do television and radio with the band. I got a lot of visibility. And the owner of a nightclub decided to do a reception for Dizzy's band and asked me to play for them. And I said, of course, I'll play. And it was after the concert. It started at midnight or 1 o'clock. And Dizzy, after he heard, of course, I was conducting from the piano, so he came to me and said, did you write all these charts? And I said, yes. How would you like to come to the United States? And I thought, I was shocked. And I said, wait a second. I mean, maybe they call him Dizzy for some other reasons.
You thought he wasn't serious.
But no, the next day he told me to go to the hotel and we talked and the whole thing finalized, and that's why I'm here today.
Isn't it amazing? And all these things that have happened really come from perhaps that meeting and the fact that you were so into that music.
Yes, well, he was very, very inspiring, and I think that the legacy he left also a responsibility, not only to continue playing his music, but also to continue extending his ideas.
That's true. Hey, let's us do another duet.
All right.
I'm getting excited. I would love to try some kind of blues thing, like that Milt Jackson tune, Stonewall.
Stonewall, yes.
Can we do that?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. And we both ended together. Amazing. This is fun. You know, it's such a kick to not only meet somebody pretty much for the first time and then get to play together. Isn't that the wonders of music, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, this is what. You know, 100 years ago, there was a gentleman in Poland, around 100, that decided to create a universal language. It was called Esperanto.
Yes.
And he wanted to see if people could communicate better. And the whole thing failed. And they created academies of Esperanto. I remember when I was a child, I was saying, here that we teach Esperanto. And it failed. Why? Because there was already a universal language, which was music.
And that's really the only one.
The only one, yeah.
The only one, because... like you were talking about Dizzy and Chano Pozzo. I mean,
absolutely.
They were able to make it even though they didn't speak any language that either one of them could understand, but the music.
That's what it means.
Yeah, it's incredible. Well, in case you just tuned into this program, my guest is Lalo Schifrin. I'm Marian McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz. I've been sort of putting off asking you, but now I'd just really have to ask you about the new thing that you've done, the new work that you did in Davenport with the Bix Beiderbecke music.
Yeah,
that must have really been something.
Yeah, that happened 2 nights ago, and it was quite a moving experience. Really, people were crying. I didn't expect that kind of reaction. And standing ovation, we had 3,000, an audience of 3,000 people with a symphony orchestra. Now Davenport joined two other cities, Moline,
Illinois. Yeah.
Tri-cities. That's where Louis Belson was born. And Louis Belson played with us. He this time, the theme of Jazz Meets the Symphony was a little bit different because the only one of the originals was James Morrison, the Australian trumpet player who also played cornet and flugelhorn, and he plays trombone. You know, he plays many instruments.
Yes.
But the rhythm section was Louis Belson on drums, and I felt it was very indicated for many reasons, not only because he was born in that region, but it's because he's kind of a bridge. He has played with musicians who had known Bix and even played Bix. It was quite a moving experience, very, very moving.
I would think so, because it's sort of like a cult following that he had, like all over the world. People know about Bix Beiderbecke, and he's sort of... somebody, you really wonder what he would have been doing if he was alive today. And I guess you brought out things that you were thinking he might have played in a certain way if he were alive today.
Yes, I didn't try to imitate him, except we had a offstage cornet, a local guy whose name is Manny Lopez. He plays very much like Bix, and he plays cornet. And he started playing the Davenport Blues offstage a cappella. And from there, the orchestra takes over. You know, it was a very, very moving because nobody could see him. And he was really off stage, you know, from the distance. And then we started, the piece is a 25-minute piece, and I developed the harmonies. And as you know, Bix, toward the end of his short life, unfortunately, he started to discover more and more the 20th century composers, especially the French Impressionists, Debussy, Ravel, and he also liked Bartok and Stravinsky. So in a way, you know, when he was playing gigs in Chicago at night, he was buying tickets to listen to the Chicago Symphony when they were playing music of Debussy or Ravel, and you can see in the midst
of it. You can tell that with that, you know.
Yeah.
And so on. That was such a wonderful piece.
It's almost like, I don't think that Thelonious Monk was ever influenced by Bix. I don't know if Monk knew about Bix, but they had something in common in the sense of that harmonic sense. And also Bix, the Bix tone, playing the trumpet, was so unique because he was so sad and at the same time so happy. I don't know how to describe it.
It's a combination of being very poignant and yet had a sort of joyful sound to it at times.
Yes. And also another thing about him, which is amazing, is that he was one of the first jazz musicians who the improvisations were not only ornaments around the melody. In those days, that was more or less what improvisation was. He was really going inside the harmony and doing... even though the chords sometimes he was using at the beginning with the Wolverines were a little bit not as extended as the one that Dizzy or Monk did, but still he was exploring and doing new melodies on those themes. And they told me that he was able to play 20 choruses. Unfortunately, 78 records, he plays very short breaks and 8 bars or something like that.
Well, he'd be in his element now. You know, I was just thinking of one of the tunes that he played that my husband Jimmy taught me. Actually, Jimmy taught me all those tunes in a mist. And maybe I could play one that Jimmy, well, I've heard Bix play it on a record. Singing the Blues?
Yeah, absolutely, it's a lovely tune.
Okay. I think I probably... play part of Bix's chorus rather than the actual melody. They've got so entwined in my mind.
Thank you.
Bravo. I really think it's so tasteful, and it shows these harmonies, the inner voices that I was talking to you about before, how, in my opinion, you influenced Bill Evans.
And
doing this with a big spoon, it shows you that jazz, the history of jazz, is almost a continuum. You know, there's no, you cannot separate it like cutting salami
you really can't.
In a delicatessen, you know, you cannot cut it. There's a continuum. One influences the other, and one source is like streams of water. I said maybe this because I've been now so close to the Mississippi River.
Well, you know, you were talking before about the melding or mixing together of jazz and classical music, and you wrote some booklet notes, and one of those, Jazz Meets a Symphony, and really, really described it very well.
Oh, I remember I said, there is an imaginary world where a street of Vienna intersects with a street in New York City. And in the corner, there is a tavern. And in the tavern, there is a piano. And around the piano, there are Duke Ellington, Dizzy Gillespie, Gustav Mahler, and Ludwig van Beethoven. And they are aware of their differences, but they are also aware of the things they have in common. And they are talking about the nature of chords, and they are exchanging ideas. And all of a sudden, more musicians start to arrive. And they start playing, and more musicians. And all of a sudden, a gigantic jam session takes place. And this is what Jazz Meets the Symphony is about.
You know what amazes me with those recordings is you write in such a way as to, you never put the symphony players in a space where they have to try to swing, because they really don't swing, do they?
No, but I keep them busy, though.
Oh, you keep them busy, yeah.
Because there are some people who use, for instance, a symphony orchestra, and the string players get bored playing long notes while the rhythm section is, and there is an alto saxophone improvising in front. So I keep them busy within their own. And also, the swing with the brass, I use triplets or quintuplets, and I try to notate the swing as close as it would come to swing. I couldn't write like that for a jazz musician. If you look at my score, sometimes when they're all playing in block, in 4-4, the jazz musician are playing 8 notes, yeah. And they know how to phrase it. But the rest of the score paper, it looks totally different.
Yeah, if you made them play that, they'd kill you or something, wouldn't they?
Well, they would be four, eight notes in one bar. You know, you cannot do that.
But, you know, I think you gave the answer then when you said you keep the orchestra busy. I think that's the answer, because it must be boring to sit there playing goose eggs all night long in long notes, you know.
No, they like it, and they like the challenge. And if you listen, for instance, Dizzy Gillespie fireworks, when they say...
Yes, right.
The violin says... Yeah. And I have everybody doing something, you know. So it's a symphonic way of approaching it, you know.
By the way, my guest is a great composer, Lalo Schifrin. I'm Marion McPartland, and this is Piano Jazz. I guess I'll never find all the answers, but your way of mixing up, like the quotes from Stravinsky, or the Firebird. I mean, how did you get the idea for doing that?
Actually, I got it first by knowing the history, the musical history. But Charlie Parker heard the Firebird. Gil Evans played the record for him.
Oh, you mean Charlie Parker heard the Stravinsky?
Yes, he had the record of Stravinsky's Firebird, and Gil Evans played it for him for the first time. And every time that Charlie Parker was going to 11th place, said, play that record for me. Then Stravinsky came to the Carnegie Hall and conducted it. With, you know, and when he found out that it was the Firebird, it was his favorite piece of classical music, probably. Mm-hmm. And Charlie Parker went to the concert. Then I saw the movie Bird by Clint Eastwood. And when Charlie Parker is in California, he spends a whole evening playing and then goes out with an actress, a Hollywood actress. And he says, I want to visit Stravinsky's house. I'd like to see if I can see him. And it's very early in the morning. They spend, and Igor Stravinsky comes out of the house. This didn't happen in history, but this was the way to convey this love for the Firebird. And the Firebird is playing from the house. He comes out to get the newspaper. So he looks at him with great admiration. And all this was starting to get into my mind. And I thought, wait a second, they call him Bird. And he was a bird on fire. And Firebird.
So
and if he liked it so much, and I start with it. And the introduction of the Firebird Suite, or the Firebird Ballet, I would say, is coincidental with the introduction of Parker's Mood.
Right.
I made the low string play and also the tempi, all of a sudden, the infernal dance of Quiche is the same tempo of Don Ali and Cherokee. So, pam, 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 So it really worked very, very well.
Oh, and you had them all in there. Now's the Time and Love a Man. You had all those beautiful
yes,
work, but they were all
there is
worked
also,
in.
There is also, actually, after the introduction, I go into the happiest period of in career-wise of Charlie Parker's life was Charlie Parker with strings. But I did my own voicing and my own, and I do a kind of medley of Charlie Parker with strings. Then I got to that Infernal Dance of Quiche, so it's a flashback in time, further back to the beginning of bebop and the revolution. That's when Don Ali, and then the sad period of his, you know, self-destruction, maybe because of the incomprehension of the public, and Loverman reflects all that with atonal passages.
And, yeah, that was beautiful.
And very poignant. And finally, I end with Now's the Time, coincidental with the last hymn of the Firebird, which is... And I made it work with the blues changes. So,
yes.
So that, and it's like affirmation. Yeah? It's like Parker leaves.
But then it got very dramatic. It's wonderful. Wonderful. Gee.
Thank you.
I want to hear you play some more, though. Are you going to play one of those tunes or something else?
Like a maybe nice... I'll play. Maybe this is time for a ballad.
Well... it's always time for a ballad
yes,
with me.
Yes. Okay, I'll do the nearness of you.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's a great tune.
Yes.
Oh, I
yes.
love that. And the last chord, I was wondering how you were going to end it.
Me too.
Well, let's do another duet, Lalo. What do you think?
Okay.
Maybe something by Dizzy.
Yeah, we've been talking about Dizzy. It's time to do something by him.
Con Alma?
Yes. Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
That is such a great piece.
Yes. It's...
Now, I'm trying to think, did he write that? I mean, when you wrote Gillespiana, had he already written that tune, do you know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But the Gillespiana, I mean, that was that the first big work that you...
The first,
you did for Dizzy?
When finally I got the Union card and all that, I went to see him. I said, man, where were you? Because I was calling him, but he was always traveling. So I, finally, one night he was playing at the Village, I think the Village Vanguard or Village Gate, and I went to see him. I said, where you been all this time? I heard that you were in New York, and I said, no, I am here now, and I can work. So, well, why don't you write something for me?
So, just like that.
Just like that. So I had to go, and I didn't think that he was going to ask me to. I thought that he was going to ask me to write arrangements, either of his tunes or standards, but to write an original. So what I decided to do is the Gillespiana, which was like a musical portrait of him. And, you know, the first movement. is a prelude, and it's jazz, and it's because he was one of the greatest jazz musicians. Then the second movement is called blues. He was born in South Carolina, and he was born around the blues. So it's... etc. And then the third movement is called Panamericana because of that association with Chano Pozo and his love for Latin American rhythm. So, you know, and then the Africana, which is his heritage, you know. And finally, the toccata, which is the synthesis of it. And then it has a bridge. You know, it's
no, that thing is marvelous. I listened to it this morning, and I was.
Yes.
It's funny. I mean, it's like you could have written that yesterday, but you were only about 20 something at the time when you wrote that, weren't you?
Yeah, we celebrated the 35th anniversary of the world premiere at the Carnegie Hall last year with John Faddis, and this year the 35th anniversary of the West Coast premiere a few weeks ago at the Monterey Jazz Festival with the same band.
But it's such wonderful, wonderful music. I mean, it's sort of ageless.
No, it's not dated.
It's not dated. I guess that's what I was trying to say.
It doesn't feel like it was written.
Well, let's finish up with, what should we do? One more Dizzy Gillespie tune?
Well, you know, Dizzy's still with us.
Dizzy is still with us. Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, I think it would be a good idea. Wouldn't you?
Okay. Thank you.
that's great. That's what jazz is about.
You've been listening to Piano Jazz with host Marian McPartland and our guest Lalo Schifrin. This program originally aired in 1997. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Richard Applegate, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production assistant Meg Hires, executive producer Tom Clark. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the Baldwin Piano Company, the Friends of Piano Jazz, NPR member stations, and NPR. Support for the digital archiving of Piano Jazz was provided by Save America's Treasures through a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Park Service Department of the Interior. Support for NPR comes from NPR contributors, which include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, and the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org. This is NPR.